nothing like a good Danish in the morning.
Did you have a Danish?
An apple and blueberry.
Oh, it's so good. I had a like a dessert cup full of cornflakes and some milk.
That's like bachelor food.
I know, it was pretty bad. I didn't feel like washing a plate.
And you're not a bachelor.
No. Shelley was frowning.
Welcome to episode 3.
Episode 3D of Extra Sequential.
Coming at you in the third dimension.
Yes, in special segments of the show, you'll be asked to put on your headphones and experience the magic of three-dimensional stereo sound.
Ooh.
There's probably no difference to anyone who's listening just then.
My name is Chris.
My name's Mladen.
And we are recording Extra Sequential, which is a new podcast coming from the capital city of Western Australia.
Perth for those not in the know. But who would not know that Perth is the capital city of Western Australia? It's common knowledge around the globe.
It certainly is in Perth. We've got a lot to get through today, which is always a good sign, and it's a political theme.
Yes, as we're recording this, it is election day here in Australia, so town is all abuzz in the most unbuzzy way.
And it's the only chance you get to visit your old primary schools and see
all
the changes and see all the weird locals that you try to avoid when you're doing your shopping.
All the children's art, which just doesn't impress you much.
No, mine was better than that.
So in today's show, we will have our election reading list. We'll be talking about a couple of comics to check out if you aren't sick of the elections just yet.
Yes, and if you're like me and you have no interest in politics whatsoever, then this is a good show for you, because if you combine politics and comics, it's like combining chocolate and coffee into a mocha-rific.
That's delicious.
I love the mocha. It's
better than what I thought you'd say.
All right.
Yeah, and we'll also be talking about the coolest bomb in the theatre right now, a sex bomb, if you will, of the box office.
Is that a Tom Jones song? Sex bomb?
Sex bomb, yeah.
No, it's sex bomb.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. On to the news. Batman Beyond was an animated series back in, the late 90s, early 2000s, I guess?
I think early 2000s would sound about right.
It's kind of a spin-off or maybe even a sequel to the Batman, the original, the animated series, which ran in the 90s.
That's right. All the same creators were involved in Batman Beyond.
And it's set in a future Gotham City where Bruce Wayne is now an aged, decrepit old man and Terry McGinnis is the new young Batman with a few fancy black suit and a red Batman symbol on his chest.
I know it wasn't too warmly accepted when it first started out.
It was quite different.
Yeah, but Bruce Timm and the same team behind the Batman animated series were involved, and they carried along the same spirit, but 2000, so there was techno music.
Yes. November 23, the complete DVD set is being released.
That's very exciting.
52 episodes, 9 DVDs. It's $100. There's a whole bunch of extras, of course, and a 24-page book detailing the art and whatnot of the series.
Oh, that's good.
So that comes out on November 23, Batman Beyond. And the comic is actually out at the moment as well. It's an
ongoing comic, isn't it?
No, it's just a miniseries. I guess I don't know.
There was a Batman Beyond comic for a while.
I think, when the cartoon was out. But this is something different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not bad. Hush is in it, and Joker, or the Tim Drake, third Robin version of the Joker.
Is in a Batman Beyond going, okay.
Yes. Well, a Hush, I think.
Who will it be?
Yes. Also, Clint magazine is Mark Miller. We talked about Mark Miller last week. He's the Scottish writer behind Kick-Ass, Nemesis, Wanted, and a bunch of stuff. The Nemesis film has just been green-lighted.
You know, I was thinking today, to our American viewers, us saying Kick-Ass is probably the dumbest thing they've ever heard.
Why?
Because it sounds really weird if you don't say Kick-Ass.
Yeah.
So our accents probably maybe that's why I didn't do too well in Australia.
Those crazy asses.
I'm not seeing Kick-Ass.
Mark Miller, he's really getting behind British comics and UK comics. So his Clint magazine, which he is a big part of, is opening on 3rd of September. And they've got an open submission policy.
Ooh.
So what that means is there's an awesome interview with him about this old magazine and why he started it on comicbookresources.com. Mm-hmm. Just look for the Mark Miller Clint magazine interview. But basically, if you go on millerworld.tv, that's millerworld.tv, that's his official website. Jump on the forums. You can hook up with writers or artists if you're either or both. And he's basically looking at 5-page stories to fit in his monthly magazine. So this Kick-Ass 2 is in there. Jonathan Ross, who's a UK television personality, he's doing his Turf series in there with Tommy Lee Edwards. So it's good. You know, he's really pushing the magazine, and he wants to get it out into the shopping centres and all that kind of stuff in the UK, and kind of
Comics back on the spinner racks?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So cool. I'm looking forward to this magazine. It comes out 3rd of September. Mm-hmm. And when it does, you can be sure...
Oh, that's not far away at all.
No, we'll certainly have a review on Extra Sequential. What we've been reading. And watching and listening to?
There will be a brief...
Smelling and poking and prodding and licking and touching.
It'll be an extra long segment this week. An extra sequential long segment.
I watched Cop Out last night, which is the first Kevin Smith film that he has directed but not written. Kevin Smith is the ultimate fanboy geek, I guess. Well, Josh Whedon would be. Kevin Smith would be his like deputy, perhaps.
Mm.
So Kevin Smith, he wrote Dogma and Clerks, Chasing Amy... I'm a huge fan.
Mallrats.
Because when he was growing up and when he was making his films, I was in film school, and so we all loved him, and he's such a geek. Cop Out stars Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan from 30 Rock TV series. Mm-hmm. It's not a good film.
Yeah.
The problem is the script. It's not funny. It tries to be Lethal Weapon. But
yeah, the trailer didn't look too good either.
No, it's just not funny. I mean, you can tell it's a Kevin Smith film because there's... mother F and this and that straight away, but it just doesn't work.
I saw some interviews with Tracy Morgan and Bruce Willis after the film, and it's really obvious that they do not like each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think Tracy Morgan...
Does that translate to the film, would you say?
They kind of get along well, but... Oh, okay.
Is there much... Yeah, do they look like buddies, or are they just sort of like... Ugh.
It doesn't seem natural in some ways, that's true. It just wasn't a funny film, unfortunately. His next film is a horror film called Red State, and that's been on the line for a while. So, yeah, it's not a remake or anything. It's an original.
Oh, no, I was thinking of Red Dawn. Sorry. Okay, no.
Oh, dear. But I do want to say...
it's being remade, so I thought, Kevin Smith's remaking Red Dawn? It could be awesome.
Is that an Arnold Schwarzenegger
Avenge
film?
Avenge me!
Is that Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, that's Red Heat.
Ah, right.
Red Dawn is where I think the Cubans invade US starting in the... they start in the center of the country, after which they'll expand out, which is probably a really poor attack choice. Starting with a small town and their high school, and it's pretty bad.
Has it got Dirty Dancing, what's his face in it? Or Patrick Swayze or someone, some young kids in it?
Patrick Swayze? I'm not too sure. You might be right. Maybe it was before he was famous. I can't remember him being in it, though.
Kevin Smith is a fantastic storyteller, and I don't know, Milan, if you've seen any of his live DVDs. He's got three DVDs called An Evening With series, and if you hear him on the first or second one, he talks about he was hired to write the script for the Superman film in the 90s when Tim Burton and Nicolas Cage was attached as Superman. Thankfully, that film never happened. But he wrote this big, long script about the death of Superman.
Am I the only one who would have been excited for that film? That sounds awesome.
Apparently, this script is online, but I haven't read the whole thing. But he talks about... look, I can't do it justice. He's such a great storyteller. If you get a chance to hear his Very Rude Smodcast or pick up any of his Evening With DVDs, he's such a great storyteller. Go on YouTube right now after we've finished speaking.
And don't go right now. Wait until we're done before you go on YouTube.
And look, and just Google Kevin Smith Superman story. It's hilarious.
Hmm.
Anyway, I also watched Clash of the Titans.
In 3D or in regular normal D?
In regular D. And I wasn't a huge fan, but... when I closed my eyes or sort of squinted, what made it bearable was...
You imagined a better film over the top?
Yes, I kept thinking that Poseidon, who's one of the Greek gods, was the Aquaman from Kingdom Come, because he had this
Does
suit.
He look like him?
Yeah, he's got the big trident and the beard. He's got this kind of shimmering suit, that, like Aquaman. Kingdom Come is a future set DC Comics series where the superheroes are old and retired.
Mm.
And, all the kind of Greek gods in the Pantheon, is that what they're called?
I think that sounds right.
Reminding me of the Justice League.
The Parthenon, the Pantheon.
Something like that. Pass it on. So, yeah, it was
you've been reading Asterix, my friend. Puns, baby, puns.
Anyway. So, not a great movie week this week.
Oh, that's
apart from Scott Pilgrim, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
And what have you been reading?
Oh, it's my turn? Cool. I picked up Alan Moore's Underground Press, magazine, not comic.
Yes.
Dodgem Logic. Which is kind of cool.
The first issue. I think it's up to the third or fourth now, and Bruce Willis is on the cover.
Is he?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's very underground.
Yes.
No, it's actually... it's interesting. It comes with a CD of all this Northampton music.
That's a region
in the UK.
Yep.
So locals there, and Alan Moore writes one of the songs. Keith, from our good friend Keith, suggests that...
From
Quality Comics suggests that he sings in it as well. I think he does towards the end. I'm not sure if it's him singing all the way through. I'll take his word for it. It could be him. It's pretty interesting.
I'd like to hear Alan Moore yodel.
You would, yeah. But you'll be disappointed, I think. No. Otherwise, I mean, there's Alan Moore obviously writes a couple of articles in it. He does a piece on the history of underground publishing, which is kind of cool.
Okay.
From starting in, like, the 1500s and stuff until the present. And there was apparently an Australian one called Oz, which seems really awesome, and I need to track it down. From the 60s-ish, you know. There's an article by Graham Lineham, who's the writer of...
IT Crowd,
Father yes. Ted, Black Books.
Awesome.
Everyone's favourite shows, I assume. And his was about Twitter, interestingly. Okay. And its power of networking, and he sort of likened it to how Paul McCartney and John Lennon met at, like, a school fair, and these two geniuses just happened to meet kind of thing.
Yes.
Like, he's saying that Twitter and this new internet age means that people who are... the skill help make it much easier to join together and team up. So what a world we live in, and
yes.
what
okay.
could happen from these kind of networking that's happening.
Good and bad things.
Mm. And there's, you know, a couple of... there's a guy who spends a month without spending a single dollar, so that it's literally him and his girlfriend rooting through trash bins for food. But, I mean, obviously you have a lot of hipster opinion pieces and rants, which aren't as good. And then you have these interesting historical and professional pieces, which are kind of cool. There's even, like, an article on a particular clothing project, like how to sew this thing.
Oh, okay.
You know, so there's a range of stuff. But, you know, I think it could take off, you know, because Alan Moore's behind it, I think, adds a lot. Otherwise, it's just a normal anything. The CD's cool. There's a lot of range of music. And as long as you can put up with the Northampton accents. I hate accents.
Yes. It's a good time to... be a comics fan. I'm very passionate about magazines, and I've tried a couple of times to get one off the ground, but that's a discussion for another time. But yeah, Wizard is kind of just becoming almost a pamphlet now. I remember when I started getting into comics in the 90s, Wizard was the be-all and end-all, was the Bible, you know, of magazines, and before the internet age, that's kind of how I learned all my geeky information.
I think film magazines are the shit now. The shit, I meant.
Is that a good thing? Is that a compliment?
That's a compliment. No, like, that's where it's at. Like, magazines which cover comics are less and less. It's comic films, I find, in a lot of these comic magazines, like Wizard and that.
Empire is my favourite magazine. I get that every month, and it's the only magazine I get every month. But, yeah, it's interesting. Like, Alan Moore, he's written Watchmen and V for Vendetta and a bunch of stuff. That Dodge and Logic sounds like an underground arty kind of thing, whereas Mark Miller, who's also a comic writer, in his Clint magazine, sounds a bit more pop culture, but I do remember reading in the CBR article where he was talking that he's got an interview with the Chinese Tom Cruise and the Indian Angelina Jolie.
The voiceover actors.
Yeah, cool. And they keep the same voiceover actors for all of their films.
Yeah, they do that in Europe for consistency.
Which I never thought of. So, yeah, that's quite an interesting thing.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
I also read Lucky Luke comic by Morris, who's the artist, and Goscinny, who was the writer behind Asterix. So these are back in the day.
So these are Belgian or French? Or
French.
Okay.
Yeah. It's called The Dashing White Cowboy. Okay. It's kind of... there's this theatre troupe that's going around, and Lucky Luke starts to suspect that they're robbing banks while the plays are going to distract everyone.
Okay.
Yep, so while one of them's off stage, he'll go quickly rob off the bank and, you know. And so he's following them to every town, so everyone suspects that he's the one robbing the banks, and it's quite funny. But the best thing about it is everyone's dim, including Lucky Luke, so they don't quite always understand that the play's not real. So there's a bit where they're reenacting Shakespeare and Romeo's fighting Tybalt, and the audience starts placing bets on who's going to win.
Okay.
And then when Romeo wins, they're like, he threw the fight! And then they tar and feather the two actors and run them out of town.
Nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I love these old comics.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like a 50-page volume, large format, kind of in the Asterix kind of...
Kind of, yeah, same format as Asterix. So if you like Asterix, there's a good chance you'll like Lucky Luke as well. So,
awesome.
Yeah, check them out. They're currently being republished by Cinebook.
Oh, yes, they do good work, actually.
Yeah, is that a Canadian publisher?
I think it might be...
Yeah.
Or English French or something.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah. But they're pretty good. They're putting out a lot of good European stuff, so check them out. I read a science fiction novel. A lot of my reading has been novels lately.
Yes.
It's a book called Eiffelheim by Michael Flynn.
Spell that.
Eiffelheim. That sounds right. Eiffelheim. It's basically set in the 14th century Germany. And what happens is their small village is, a group of interdimensional aliens that get stranded there.
Okay.
So it's kind of a first contact story set in the 14th century superstitious Christian Germany.
Okay.
So the main character is like the priest in the town, and he's got a bit more of a scientific mind because a lot of the sciences were born from Christian universities, you know, their logic applications and so forth. So he's kind of like the voice of compassion for them because they're stranded and away from home and sick. It's pretty cool.
Okay.
It's been nominated for a Hugo Award, obviously big deal in science fiction.
Which is like the best science fiction novel of the year kind of thing.
That's correct. I think Watchmen won a Hugo Award at some stage, didn't it?
I think it was Sandman. Oh, no, Sandman won a World Fantasy Award.
I'm pretty sure Watchmen won a Hugo Award, okay. And then after that they stopped allowing... It won the Novel Award,
okay.
And then after that they stopped allowing graphic novels to be nominated for the best novel.
With pictures aren't high literature.
Yes. My monocle is cracked. It also won a Robert A. Heinlein Award, which is pretty good. That was a pretty awesome book, so people should check it out.
Cool. I have been reading, or I just finished reading, it just came out this week actually, a wonderful Image series called The Light. It's a 5-issue series. The writer is Nathan Edmondson. He's new to comics in a way. He wrote a series called Olympus last year, also with Image, and that's great. You can pick it up on trade. It's basically two eternal Greek brothers who have a deal with Zeus, and it's Greek gods, and it's kind of like a John Woo film, as if he made Clash of the Titans, kind of. Anyway.
Speaking of John Woo, did you watch Face Off a few nights ago?
I don't watch TV.
Oh.
I just watch DVDs or...
There's really weird editing in that film, really? Eh? They'll be like talking and suddenly there'll be this slowdown shot of someone just doing something stupid. It's just, yeah. It was, I still love that line, I'm going to take his face off. His face off? Off.
Is that Nicolas Cage?
Or that's Nicolas Cage and some dude. It's pretty awesome.
Cool.
Best Nicolas Cage film.
Sorry. So, The Light.
Right.
Written by Nathan Edmondson and art by Brett Waddell, who did, I don't know if you know, that's how you say his name, Brett Waddell. Anyway, he did The Surrogates, which is far better than the film. The Light is basically
about this
light virus. So, it starts off in, I think, Portland, Oregon. It's a little country town and this... this kind of deadbeat dad.
I see glowing eyes.
Yeah, this deadbeat dad kind of takes his daughter and they're trying to avoid the lights. Every time you look into a light source, be it a light bulb or headlights or whatever, you basically spontaneously combust and you kind of electrocute yourself from within. Hmm. So they're just walking around this dark city, meeting other survivors. There's like a plane crash and, yeah, it's pretty interesting. So, yeah, they're walking around with like, yeah, welder's masks and goggles and blindfolds and stuff on to...
Oh, yeah?
And it gets... It's quite a well-written series. I mean, it's quite moody. It's dark. It's kind of... It doesn't really answer a lot of questions. We don't really know where the light comes from. It doesn't really have much happiness throughout the... It's not a funny book at all, but it's very simple. It's almost like quite a streamlined story. Not a lot happens necessarily. It's just a man and his daughter trying to find out what this virus is and just trying to survive, basically.
Is there shades of zombie apocalypse in this?
No. It's quite... It's like a microcosm. It's kind of like The Road.
The stories, like 28 Days Later, it's really about them trying to... Everyone else is infected and they're trying to...
Well, we don't know anyone else. That's the wonderful thing about the story. It's such a microcosm.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much they're the only two main characters in it.
Yes.
It reminded me of The Road, the Cormac McCarthy novel, and the film, which is awesome. It's very depressing.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of like that. It's like this big, massive thing. You don't know how big this virus is, but it's just centered on these two characters.
Cool.
So, I actually just interviewed Nathan Edmondson on BrokenForIdea.com, where he talks about The Light and its ending and all that kind of stuff.
So it's just a miniseries, 5 issues?
It's just a miniseries. The trade comes out in December.
Do you think there'll be a sequel?
Focusing
on different characters, maybe?
He does talk about that in the interview, but I don't believe so. I think it is quite a done-in-one kind of story, and if that's you read good. All 5 issues, you'll understand why. It's really good.
I like these kind of self-contained things. Like, I don't have to keep reading 58 issues, and then it gets cancelled before the ending happens, which happens quite a bit, and that's just frustrating.
Yes. And it's great art. It's very dark art. Brett Waddell's art just really works in The Light. So, yeah, The Light, 5-issue from Image. Pick it up or get the trade in December. Awesome comic.
Bit of a Ben Templeman vibe behind
this. Oh, yes. There's a bit of a joke. I was talking to the guys at the comic shop this morning. Our local paper, The West Australian, had an interview a couple of days ago.
They got everything wrong.
With Wolfgang Bielsma from Gestalt Comics, who's
Perth publisher.
Do great stuff. Like Rombies and Changing Ways.
Flinch, bunch of good stuff.
Yeah. And so they interviewed him, they got a whole bunch of facts wrong. And my blood was boiling. I was going to send an angry letter to the editor, but I restrained myself. So I just put it up on my blog and pointed out the errors.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll learn their ways.
Apparently on the online one, they fixed a lot of the mistakes.
They did.
But I was reading the print paper and I was like, I love Ben Templeman. And
should be Ben Temple Smith, by the way, 30 Days of Night artist, who's a local guy.
That's right.
And they got a whole bunch of other stuff wrong. Anyway, at least it's good publicity in some way.
Should I mention what else I've been reading?
There's a guy in a purple suit fighting an alligator.
Kind of Billy Zane-ish, would you say?
In the Titanic?
No, in the Phantom.
Yes.
One of the best films of all time. No, I went on a bit of a Phantom binge.
Okay.
Phantom is one of... I picked up... Well, I've always had these kind of hidden on my bookshelf. But as a kid, these were comics I remember reading back in the 90s. And I was a kid at the 90s, just so you know.
Yes, I was a kid at the 80s.
Setting my age there. But I found the... Well, it's the first comic I ever remember buying with my own money. And they're the... like, some people diss the Phantom and all that, saying the art's kind of crap. But I'm just showing these to Chris now.
Get it out of my face. No, it's actually not that bad. It's black and white. It's kind of cheap newspaper. And it's almost... If you're a comic fan in Australia, the Phantom is one of those things which you go through. The Phantom is everywhere in Australia, every news agent.
Oh, yeah.
You go to, like, show bag.
And then the covers look like crap. That's the problem. The covers just always look really bad.
But they're always cheap. They're into, like, you know, $2-3. Mm.
But I'm, like, especially in the 90s, I don't know about the recent ones, they tend to be more crappy than good.
Okay.
But in the 90s, they had a period where they would focus on a lot of the stories of the previous Phantoms, you know, like the 13th Phantom, and, you know...
Should we describe who the Phantom actually is?
Okay, basically there's about 22 generations of this family, and they keep passing down this the Phantom role, which is a protector of the... It's based in the jungle. He's basically like Tarzan, but in a purple suit.
Yes.
But he has like a lineage.
And he has two guns.
Yeah, he's one of few heroes who shoots people, because he doesn't have any powers. So.
Yeah.
And also dubbed The Ghost Who Walks.
Yes.
He who locals, looks upon his face will die a horrible death.
The locals think he will never die because they don't. They think it's the same man, but it's the son.
That's right. So it's like this legend kind of thing. But I'd say with the Phantom, if you're going to check him out at all, grab any of the ones which are set in a historical period, because they're forced to get better artists on them, because they have to draw this historical period setting stuff.
And the art does look good there, I must say. Mm.
There's a 70s sort of creepy, you know...
eerie and creepy. That
yeah,
kind
those
of
magazines.
Vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Batman, or former Batman artist Graham Nolan, actually did some work on the Phantom newspaper.
Wouldn't surprise me. Yeah,
and I think he might even still be doing it.
These are the Australian Phantom comics, by the way. Phantom originally published, sort of started off in the mid 30s, I believe, by Lee Falk,
created
the
by
publisher
Lee Falk.
In
yes.
Australia. Yeah, and Australia and Switzerland and wherever else are still the only countries publishing new Phantom stories, but. Recently, Dynamite, was it?
Yeah, Phantom's kind of back in vogue now. Yeah, as we mentioned, Billy Zane's, I think there's a film in the mid-90s where...
With Catherine Zeta,
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
In her hot 20s phase.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dynamite have just got the right... Dynamite Entertainment are a kind of independent publisher. They publish a lot of the older, so they do Sherlock Holmes, Buck Rogers... Zorro, Lone Ranger, that kind of stuff. They've just got picked up the rights for Flash Gordon, so they do a lot of the old pulpy kind of heroes. And the series that just been
they're also publishing Dan Dare. That's another one from back in
true.
The day.
Yeah, and Green Hornet. Which Kevin Smith was going to make a Green Hornet film before the current Seth Rogen came out, so his screenplay has been turned into a Green Hornet comic.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually quite a good comic.
Well, I do like Michel Gondry, so I'm curious to see what he does.
He's the director of the film. So The Last Phantom, number one, comes out this week. It's got awesome covers by Alex Ross and Scott Beatty, who did a lot of Batman comics in the 90s as well. He's back on writing duty. So
it's kind of a coincidence. Chris brought this in today, saying, and I had just the night before gone through all these older Phantom comics and flicking through this new one, great cover. Interior art, not to my taste, I would say.
The interior art, as I said, written by Scott Beatty. Interior art is by Eduardo Ferragato.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. It's not too bad. It's basically Kit Ridgewalker. Mm-hmm. And then when the film starts, it's
blasphemy. Like it should be Christopher Walker.
He's got a shaved head.
Christopher Walken.
Shaved head. He's running around in a suit and a briefcase that he takes with him everywhere. Of course, we don't know what is in the briefcase. Or do we?
Or do we?
Of course we do. And he goes back to... is it Bengali? Is that the name?
Yes, Bengali.
He kind of protects the people
Bengali,
there.
Yeah.
And there's like assassinations and stuff. And then he doesn't put on the purple duds, but he puts on like a ripped
He's covered
cloth.
In blood.
He's covered in blood. He puts on his rings and his little domino mask and he gets into action. Oh, yeah, honestly.
It definitely looks more like a superhero comic in terms of the art, I would say.
It does, that's true.
Yeah. Whereas the older ones have the adventure art thing, so it's just different strokes for different folks. I guess they're trying to reimagine him to appeal to the kind of superhero market.
Well, I hope they explain a bit more. Like, he seems to go to, I'm a rich philanthropist, into, I'm a man of action, I'm a jungle hero, quite quickly. So hopefully they explain
the
backstory.
You're not familiar
a bit
with
more.
The Phantom backstory, are you, that much?
There was something about dead pirates and someone swearing at a skull. And
his family, he was travelling on a ship, well, this is back in the 13th century kind of thing.
Yep.
And they were attacked by pirates, obviously, who become the archenemy of the family. And then the little kid is stranded, his parents are dead, which is a typical superhero trope, I would say. And he's saved by this African tribesman, who sort of make him their own, and he swears that day to always protect the innocent and that sort of thing.
And when he said that, a lightning rode across the sky. I will swear vengeance upon my graves of my parents. Justice is mine, that kind of thing.
Yeah. If you like that sort of thing, yeah, fine.
Okay.
I imagine a more low-key affair with martinis.
Just
and
a promise to myself with holding your hand over your heart.
I promise myself I'd never fall in love again. With crime. Anyway.
So that's the Phantom.
But, yeah, I love these old Phantom comics.
There's something for everybody. He's lasted. He's one of those, I mean, we say Superman is the first superhero, but really, and I much as I hate to admit that because I do love Superman, the Phantom, created in 1936, is the first real kind of superhero. He didn't have superpowers, but I guess he's got a costume
he's
and a secret
got a costume,
identity.
I mean, yeah.
And
so, yeah.
He's got a dog and a horse. And a mask. Is he married or the Kit Walker?
Yeah, he usually finds a wife. He likes well-educated types, actually.
Don't we all?
Oh, of course, baby. and then he'll usually have a couple of kids, usually a boy and a girl. And the boy's usually called Christopher or Kit. And the boy carries down the line, and the girl, they never really. There's never diverging lines in the Phantom family tree. It's always like the man's bloodline.
Okay.
I wonder what, like, Phantom's cousin twice removed, you know, like from his great grandmother's side. I wonder
they don't
what
talk
they're
about
doing.
Him.
They don't talk about
him. He doesn't show up
there's
in
a bit
the
of
family,
family
photos.
There's a bit of family history there. Yeah. We don't talk about Uncle Larry.
There was a Larry, the almost Phantom.
Larry Walker.
There was a
the man who walks.
There was a TV series. The Sci-Fi Channel in America released a pilot of a prospective TV series of The Phantom. And yeah, it's Kit Walker, 21st century.
Is like this recent?
Yeah, a couple of months ago.
Wow. Okay.
And it's bad. I picked it up on DVD. He has kind of a purple outfit, and they show it in the film. Like he doesn't know about his history. He's been adopted. His parents died, and he's like a parkour guy. So when you first see him, he's jumping across rooftops and you know, there's rock and roll music behind it.
Do they investigate his secret weakness? Phantom has a secret weakness. Okay, it's not well known and they never mention it in the comics, but I know what it is. Getting hit in the back of the head. If you read any Phantom comic, it'll happen. He'll be sneaking around somewhere and someone will sneak up behind him and hit him in the back of the head and he'll be knocked out and putting some sort of...
Well, I think that would happen to everybody, regardless of if you're the
So it's a normal secret weakness, but yeah, it's a pretty typical plot device used in Phantom comics, so just for those in the know, that might ring a bell.
Yes. but yeah, the Phantom pilot wasn't that great. It was written by, I think, Charles and Daniel North, who've written a few Iron Man comics, but father and son writing team. Mm. Yeah, he kind of bulks up and he looks at the original purple costume and goes, I'm not wearing that. And then he has this like this armoured thing with a like Modus Hulk helmet and gun. It's boring is what it was and just didn't work.
Mm. I think we should move on to our review of Scott Pilgrim.
Yes.
We are Sex Bob-omb and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff. I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of calm, the feminine abyss, and reaching my threshold, staring at the tricks of the blind. My body's stupid, stereo putrid, spilling out music in the raw sewage, reaching my threshold, staring at the tricks of the blind.
That was from the soundtrack of film Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, which has just come out.
Yes, and it's based on a 6-volume Oni Press black and white series by Canadian writer-artist Brian Lee O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
Volume 6 has only just been released in late July, I believe it was.
That's right, to coincide with the release of the film, I believe.
And the film is directed by Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright, creator...
British.
Yep, scriptwriter and director of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, two excellent English comedy/action films.
Have you ever seen his TV series Spaced?
I've watched a couple of minutes here and there, but I've never been able to catch a whole lot. It looks like my sort of show.
I'll lend you the DVD. It reminded me of Scott Pilgrim. It's just, you know, it's zany, kind of non sequiturs and kind of filled with pop culture references.
Yeah, some of the references, I'm like, that's great.
Yeah.
It's
made for people like us.
There was one where it was the universal language of men. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? Observe. And then he slow motion pulls his fingers out in gun.
Oh, in space you're talking
in
about.
In space,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
And all the guys know exactly what to do.
And then there's a battle. Around.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Spaced.
Ah, spaced. We're not talking about spaced, are we? We're talking about Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I caught the film last week.
Did you watch it twice?
I was going to watch it twice. I'm going to watch it again last night, but I'll probably watch it tomorrow instead because my partner hasn't watched it yet, and I'm going to force her to go see it. So.
Cool.
Yep.
I liked it, I must say.
I really liked it. Yeah.
I had high hopes. It's interesting, you know, whenever you see a film that is adapted from a comic, you have certain expectations in mind, usually low. But
never.
It's quite a hard series to adapt. As I said, 6 volumes, that's like over 1,000 pages of stuff.
And yeah.
So obviously not all of that can. I mean, probably only like, what, 20, 30% at the best.
I've only read the first volume, so I wouldn't know.
Made it into the film. I've read all 6 and I've loved it. I picked it up last year and a friend recommended it to me and then I just picked up all 6, and it's basically, it follows Scott Pilgrim, who's played by Michael Cera in the film from Arrested Development. He seems to play the same character all the time, so hopefully you can
he's
get
a little
break.
Bit different as Scott Pilgrim, though. I think
he's a bit more manly, I think, in this
he's
one.
More manly,
more stand up for himself,
yeah,
a bit more.
Knows what he wants maybe a bit more, yeah.
So it's about, yeah, it's set in Canada, and it's basically, it's almost like a pop culture laden soap opera. It's all his friends and hangers on.
They've likened it to a musical, but instead of the musical sequences where reality changes and everyone starts dancing, there are fight scenes. I reckon that's a good way to describe
that's
it.
True.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
So, yeah, Scott Pilgrim meets the girl of his dreams, literally, Ramona Flowers.
Yes.
And at the start of their relationship, he's also dating a high schooler, which is frowned upon by his friends.
And I found her very attractive.
She's a very beautiful young lady. Chris.
Yeah. Ellen Wong. That's the name of the actress.
Yeah.
I believe.
Chris is how old?
Well, I don't think she's 17 or whatever in real life.
Chris is saying if he was Michael Cera, he'd have picked Ellen Wong.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, I would have too. But he then finds out that Ramona comes with emotional baggage in the form of 7 evil exes.
Yes, not ex-boyfriends, as she corrects him in the film, but exes, because she had a lesbian phase.
Yes, which works nice, and Scott must fight them all for her, kind of for her love.
Yes.
Yeah, and then for other reasons, as he finds out later, which is a nice little metaphor for how we all kind of... When you first start dating a girl, there's that moment where you realize, oh, she's dated other guys.
Yeah.
And you have to get over that yourself in your head. Whereas in Scott's world, because he's so absorbed in this world of video games and pop culture, for him, it's in fighting. And she's his Princess Peach.
Is that Mario?
Yes.
Okay.
She is the prize.
But Mario never loved Princess Peach.
Yeah, but she was the prize for Mario, right?
I see.
He was on this quest to fight these guys.
To rescue Princess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is kind of almost how they present her in the film, I thought. I didn't think she was very well developed in the film. I'd say that's maybe a...
Yeah, I've heard a few people say that, and I tend to agree. She's like, would I really fight for her? She's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who plays John McClane's daughter. And
quite an attractive girl, 4.0. I would say.
But she kind of aloof. And
I thought she was a bit too aloof, I would have liked. Because in the comic I read, the first one, she had a bit of a sense of humour. She was smiling a bit more. Bit more charming, I would say.
I think the problem with the film, it's, you know, what, under 2 hours, and it's got a lot of characters to get through. Even the fight, it's like 7 fight scenes.
Yeah.
Plus, or the exposition, plus, or the zaniness.
7 great fight scenes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a lot to get through.
Yeah.
And so, I think the film, the comic has a lot more just people.
Yeah, they can go into
subplots.
Chewing
the breeze.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
you get a bit of that in the film, and some of those scenes are hilarious. And Edgar Wright adds his directorial touch. There's a great Seinfeld moment.
Yes,
which
had
a
laugh track.
That was one. And the Seinfeld bass slap, and it was brilliant.
There are scenes in the film that are straight from the comic, like when he meets Ramona and when he sees Ramona in her dreams, and then he orders something from Amazon.
Yeah,
he sits by the door.
Yeah, a lot of it was straight from the comic right down to the dialogue, because the first volume was fresh in my mind when I saw the film.
And the ending is pretty much the same.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Because it's interesting because the first volume of Scott Pilgrim came out in 2004. And a couple of producers found this and then they gave it to Edgar Wright. Said, you should make a film of this. But he was already busy, you know, doing Hot Fuzz and whatever. So he basically said, this is awesome. I'm going to wait for O'Malley to catch up, because he knew that there was 5 more volumes to go. So he waited for him to catch up, and then they kind of... Brian Lee O'Malley was writing the end of the film while the filmmakers were kind of filming as well, so they kind of had a bit of tandem, so that's why the end is quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
So it is quite a similar... even though a lot of the content doesn't go from the page to celluloid, it is a very, very faithful adaptation and very funny adaptation.
I thought it was pretty...
if you've got ADD, this is a film for you.
I thought it was interesting that, it talks about this kind of obsession with video games and pop culture broader sense. I think Edgar Wright has always been enmeshed in that.
He's got an X-Men jacket on at one stage, rips the
X. He's got the X on his shoulder, That's when they start talking about the evil X's, and then he's like, and rips off the shoulder patch.
You see his X's everywhere in the
street. It's pretty funny. But, no, they're so enmeshed in this world, and the film reflects that, but it kind of comments on that obsession as well, because his kind of goal-oriented nature of winning points from fighting these guys, I think he comes to a realization later in the film, which makes him realize maybe it's not the best for his relationships in the long term to treat everything like in the shallow sense that he might. Let's keep this... Should we keep the conversation spoiler-free, I think?
Sure, why not?
As much as we can, I think. There's certain things... we won't talk about the ending, for example.
I did know that he only picked the coins up for the, when he defeated the first guy.
You would have been grabbing those coins.
Like a video game when you... Is that from Mario? When you hit someone and you defeat them, they spread into coins and they give you more money to buy stuff?
No, in Sonic Rings... Oh, no, rings fly out of you when you get hurt.
Oh, okay.
No, but I'm sure there's something where you hit guys and coins fly out. It's not Mario. That's when you hit blocks.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I should know that.
There's a lot of hidden jokes I found, almost like...
it's very fast, so, you know, there's a lot of jokes that fly out.
Short scenes. A lot of stuff happens in the background sometimes, like the Naked Gun films or the Flying High films.
Mm.
Like a lot of stuff that just kind of happens in the periphery. Yes. Like they're not the main jokes, but it's a lot of kind of... Like when he dives through the window.
Yeah.
When... Knives Chow.
Yeah, it's like when O.J. Simpson was in the Naked Gun films and, like, he'd be getting injured in the background while Leslie Nielsen is,
That kind of stuff.
O.J. Simpson.
So, yeah, I think we can really say that we liked the film.
I would recommend people check it out. I think...
It's one of those films you'll get more out of if you have seen the comic, because the comic is a richer world because it can afford to be. And also with the film, it's a lot funnier in the first half. The second half gets a bit more serious and emotional.
Yeah. I think your film... Like, Hot Fuzz had the same thing, if you remember. Like, okay, it had the action things at the end, but it had a turn to the serious... Maybe Shaun of the Dead's probably a better example.
Yes.
Because they're having fun and all this, and then they get attacked by the zombies and it's no longer a laughing matter.
Yes.
Something similar happens in this, but there's never really... in Scott Pilgrim, I should say.
Yeah.
But there's never really a point where you feel like any of them are in danger. I think the fights
are... that's true. They're always kind of fun.
Yeah.
And I was just... After I saw the film, I was flicking through the 6 volumes by Oni Press, and especially this last volume, there's a huge... Between 1 to 6, his artwork has changed so much. It was a bit crude in the first volume, particularly, whereas I think it's a bit more refined and a bit more expressive in volume 6. And they're all black and white. They're all kind of smaller comics. Not something you could fit in your back pocket quite, but...
Yeah, about manga size.
But volume 6, it almost like... It is, even though it is black and white, but it's almost like... That's the sound of Scott Pilgrim on paper. Oh. It's almost like it doesn't need colour because it's such a vibrant world, even though it's in black and white. Like, it's just, the pages are just filled with activity and just little flashbacks and big text. And
I think the film's like that as well, text especially.
Yeah, that's true. And the music, we should mention
the music's pretty amazing.
Scott Pilgrim is actually a band, Sex Bomb, as we mentioned. And there's a lot
Bomb, not Sex Bomb.
Bomb.
Yes, after the Mario Bomb-Bombs.
Oh, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Oh, I was wondering where they're from.
Yeah.
I'm not as much into video games of the 80s and 90s as Milanin is.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
You get all the references.
I like the retro stuff.
Yes.
But the music, the score is by Nigel Godrick, who produced a lot of Radiohead albums, those sort of things. And you can recognize his touch. And through the score, there are certain bits which he borrows sort of heavily from The Warriors, which is an amazing 70s cult film.
Yes.
Of a gang trying to escape.
Come out to play.
Yeah. Yep. Just, I'm not going to explain The Warriors. Check it out because it's awesome.
Yes.
And I think there's even a musical kick cue from Halloween 2. When he's fighting a certain powered ex-boyfriend.
Okay, possibly. And
played by a superhero Brandon Routh, alumni. Routh. There's a few superhero alumni.
Chris Evans is in there.
Yes, Chris Evans, Brandon Routh. I thought all the ex-boyfriends and girlfriend, I'll say, because she's in the trailers, were really all good.
They're in there for quite a short amount of time, but quite funny.
Chris Evans was hilarious. He does this kind of Clint Eastwood voice. Yes. And he's, oh, that's funny. That's actually really funny. No, he's good. And Brandon Routh's hilarious. Ooh.
I did notice when the film started, even the Universal logo.
Yes.
It was like the Universal made the film, and they had to like pixelate
it. It sets the stage.
The music and stuff.
Yeah. But the music, the Sex Bomb songs are by Beck.
Yes.
Wrote the music, and then they're performed in the film by Michael Cera and the other two actors.
They actually played their instruments.
They play their instruments and sang themselves.
Cool.
And the soundtrack versions have both versions on them, so you can hear Beck's originals on there too.
Beck was in Futurama as well.
Yeah. As the head of Beck.
Headed, yes.
Yes, as they often do.
Yeah, I actually, usually the only kind of soundtracks I pick up are, you know, like I've got the Halo soundtrack and the Superman the Movie soundtrack and that kind of stuff, orchestral stuff, but I did pick up, I was watching the film, listening to the music, so I want to buy this.
Do you ever pick up a soundtrack of a film you haven't seen?
No.
Yeah. No. Okay, no. I'm just, like, I sometimes will. I find if there's a particular artist I like and who's interested in it. I was recently listening to the Into the Wild soundtrack. I don't want to see the film.
Yeah, it's a great film.
Okay. But Kaki King, who I really like as a female guitarist, she performs on there, and I really dug the soundtrack. It's still not enough to make me want to see the film, though.
And in order to give you the full Scott Pilgrim experience...
Oh, sorry. Fine.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if we were both wearing Scott Pilgrim underwear, we couldn't give you more of a Scott Pilgrim experience. We've talked about the comics, the film.
Which you should see, because it's not doing especially well at the moment.
No, unfortunately. I think people are kind of perplexed by it and confused. It's for a certain generation, I think.
I think there's a bit of a resentment towards it, actually, from people I've talked to.
Trying to be too clever or something.
Yeah, they feel it's like, what is this movie? Who do they think they are? Kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. But, yeah, so over its opening weekend, I mean, the film's budget was about $60 million.
Yep.
Over its opening week, I should say, it only made $10 million in the US.
Wow.
So around the world, you can probably double that, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that and a half, because Australia, you know, other countries might not catch on to it as quickly. But usually with these kind of films, especially high-budget films, the first week will be half or a third of the overall take of the film through its entire run, theatrical run. So $10 million is not a good opening for a film that costs $60
million. I think it'll, like Kevin Smith's films, I think it'll do heaps well on DVD.
Oh, yeah. Kick-Ass had that thing. It didn't do well in theatres at all. Similar, actually, opening.
Yeah.
And on Blu-ray and DVD, it's I think it's made back its budget.
I think it's got a loyal audience.
So I think that'll happen with this. And with Scott Pilgrim, as well as with Kick-Ass, they were giving away a lot of free tickets at Comic-Cons.
Yes,
and that
true.
Sort of thing. So you can damage your potential audience is getting to see it for free, and for a film which doesn't have a broad appeal, might not be the best choice. So go see it. Take your mum.
There's a game, a Scott Pilgrim game, which you would love, Maladdin. It's available on the PlayStation Network.
It looks
good. Download it.
Yeah.
It actually even comes with a zombie unlock code, so you can fight zombies. But yeah, it's a very retro game. I like my FPS as my first person.
Reminds you of
games.
Two Crude Dudes or something like that. Bad Street Brawlers, any of these classic beat-em-up games.
Walking along and you fight everybody you see, you're just walking along the street. You can pick up baseballs and...
I love those games so much.
Stuff you find on the street, and then when you punch them, they go into coins and... You got a couple of special moves. One of your special powers is a lightning bolt comes down and Ramona comes down and love comes out. She gets you people.
I like
love
games
powers.
Where there's only like a couple of buttons.
Yeah, there's like a punch and a kick and a special attack and a jump.
I love that.
It's funny. Not my cup of tea. But
is there a lot of variation in the levels? Or
I've only played the one level. $15 for the whole game, which isn't too bad.
That's
but
good.
It starts off like kind of like the Mario games do, where you're a little icon and you kind of move along. Don't know why I'm moving my hands at the moment, but...
I can see you, Chris.
Thanks, that's the main thing. We can't talk much more about Scott Pilgrim. I think we've covered everything.
I think
games,
so.
Comics.
Overall, would you recommend to see it, and should people see it?
I think young people would get more out of it if you like, you know, watching the
How
Bill
young,
and
actually?
Doing crosswords on a Sunday afternoon. This probably isn't the film for you necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't know, 40 and below.
Yeah, I would say that because when I was in the theatre, for example, I did notice there were some under 17s. And some say over 35s.
Okay.
And they definitely seem to enjoy it the least.
Yeah.
I think under 17s just won't get it.
No.
I think it's a bit too Speed Racer in some respects. But it's... I think anyone who's, I'd say late 20s to early 30s, I think would get the most out of this film because it delivers on all the promises of your childhood.
Yes. You know,
there hasn't been a good video game movie.
No.
Can you think of any good
Street
ones?
Fighter. Oh, no, hang on. You said good. No.
No. I mean, there might be hope with... have you seen that Mortal Kombat? It's not
yes.
a trailer, but it was like a pitch to get money to make
yes.
a film.
Yes,
with Michael J. that. White. And, yes. Yeah. And that looks pretty sweet. So if that made, that could be the first good video game movie.
Yeah.
Could be. But Scott Pilgrim, it's not based on a video game, but I would say it's the first good video game movie.
Yeah, that's a good
point. Has so much of it.
True.
Yeah.
Watch it.
I'd say watch it. And I'm not going to tell you to go support a film you're not interested in, but I would say it'll probably appeal to more people than you might think.
And if you don't like that, you might watch The Expendables.
You shouldn't.
Oh, I want to watch that. I can't help myself. I saw the poster, and I put this on my blog, and had a list of tally of all the stars and how many people they've killed.
Yeah, killed. Yeah, that's good.
Dolph Lundgren killed 41 people in Masters of the Universe.
I'd say...
What? Yeah, man doesn't kill people.
Now, Scott Pilgrim and Expendables, I think they have something in common that they're both appealing to this nostalgia.
Yes, that's true.
And there's a lot of action in both
films. Different decades. They're unapologetic, you know. There's a sense of fun about them.
Oh, we didn't mention the action scenes in Scott Pilgrim.
They are good.
They're really good.
I didn't know how good they'd be because Edgar Wright's not necessarily an action director.
Hot Fuzz, baby. Do you remember the action
scenes
in that?
Yeah, I guess.
He fly kicks, say, an old woman in the face in that.
I must have blanked that out. But yeah, it's actually quite good and quite psychedelic and trippy. And
yeah, there's a scene like Michael Cera seems to kick ass in this film.
It's quite the visual treat.
Yeah, great fight scenes. Some of them choreographed by choreographers who'd worked with Jackie Chan.
Oh, okay.
I think one had worked with Jet Li at some stage. So Hong Kong, you know,
yes.
is high. And
they know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing.
As and Hong Kongians.
With Edgar Wright's sort of editing and directorial touch, everything just like bam, bam, bam. It's
yes.
really
Thank
energetic
you.
And all
Thank
that.
You, man.
That bit of a peak there. On the waveform. I won't do this anymore after now.
I'm going to slap you now. Okay, that's it.
That's enough.
Scott Pilgrim.
See ya.
You opened our hearts and our eyes. Wow.
Now on to Extra Sequential's election coverage, 2010, the epic battle.
Yes. wow. Mm. It's a political weekend here in Australia.
Yeah,
we've
it is.
Both voted, last weekend.
Exercised my democratic rights to vote. Although in Australia, you don't have the right not to vote, as in the US.
And I went in there on Saturday and I dropped off the electoral poll.
Woo.
And you said I was like Will Smith in Enemy of the State.
You were. Gene Hackman was helping you escape from Jack.
Someone.
Is Jack Black in that movie? I feel like he is. I have a feeling Jack Black.
Jack Black's in Anchorman.
Jamie Kennedy is in it. You know Jamie Kennedy?
Oh, that guy. He's dating Jennifer Love Hewitt or something.
That doesn't surprise me.
Like, he's not that attractive, but he's a funny man, so girls love
I
funny
liked
men.
Him in the Scream movies.
Yet somehow I remain single. It's a mystery.
Yeah, you know Jamie Kennedy. You know right. Matthew Lillard. All 90s.
Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah.
All right, so yeah, politics. So we thought this would be a good time to kind of do a countdown.
Extra Sequential's election reading list.
10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1, go.
Right.
So first of all, we wanted to mention, our first episode, we talked about Lex Luthor as president.
Mm.
In 2000, in the comics, Lex Luthor, Superman archenemy, became president of the United States in the DC Comics series. He helped rebuild Gotham City after there was an earthquake in the No Man's Land series. And then basically he got through because he removed fossil fuels. He was pushing technology. Eventually he used a bunch of drugs, including presidents and drugs. Drug which Venom which Bane uses. Mm. Bane is this big hulking guy that broke Batman's back. So he used Venom when fighting Superman, who he framed to say, "Oh, this kryptonite meteor is coming down. He's going crazy." Anyway, that's it.
I'm just joking.
Superman, Batman, Public Enemies animated film. You could tell more about that. So he left office after
the evil president.
Yep, the evil prez. So Lex Luthor left office. He was in there for 3 years, apparently, in the story. So he left office after Batman filmed him because Lex Luthor admitted that he gave Doomsday, who killed Superman, he gave this Doomsday creature to Darkseid, who's the intergalactic despot, for some powerful weapons. So he got kicked out of office. He returned to the head of LexCorp, which is his company. And Lex Luthor is currently star. He's currently the star of Action Comics, which I think is DC Comics' longest running series. No, that would be Detective Comics. Anyway, it's written by Paul Cornell, and he in Action Comics, and Lex fights a different supervillain each issue. It's actually pretty good. So for a short while, Lex Luthor was the president, and
was fighting supervillains as president.
Well, kind of, but not publicly. And okay. I don't think they did enough with it. He also appeared in Smallville in the episode Hourglass in season one. There's like a flash forward where this old woman had visions of Lex, and he's like in the white suit in the Oval Office.
In the comic, do they look into the election itself, or is he just suddenly president?
It happened pretty quickly from memory.
Mm.
But yeah, unfortunately, it could have been an awesome idea, but DC just didn't do enough.
Maybe
with
one
it.
Day someone will come in and write the epic Lex Luthor election campaign
Maybe.
Comic.
He'll get re-elected. But yeah, there's a lot of presidents in comics. Barack Obama last year appeared in Spider-Man. He teamed up with Savage Dragon. A whole bunch of... He was like the guest star of the year last year.
You can add that to your reading list, yes. I'm sure. Next up, Cerebus, Church and State. You might have heard of Cerebus in the giant phone book-sized tomes by Dave Sim and Gerard. Gerard's a Canadian artist, and okay. I think Dave Sim's Canadian as well.
Quite possibly.
I don't want to accuse him of being Canadian if he's not. No, we're good friends with our Canadian listeners,
mm-hmm.
both of you. Cerebus is basically a satire comic based of the swords and sorcery genre, except with an aardvark as the main character. In this particular volume, the conquering warrior Cerebus, he returns to Lest, and he's basically roped and manipulated into becoming PM as a puppet, basically, for the rulers there.
Okay.
In the mad rush for power, there's a whole bunch of ballot rigging. What they do is they find where he's getting the most votes, and they split that up into two electorates, so he'll get two seats there, you know, those kind of...
Okay.
Dave Sim goes into this kind of quite an interesting political satire there, and that's the first turning point in the comic from just being this thin sword and sorcery yep. thing to looking at these broader issues of politics and relationships and all this stuff, which is when the comic starts to come into its own. And in the course of this comic, he's elected, well, he makes himself Pope. So he's the head of church and state, as in a very Henry VIII kind of way.
Okay.
And he declares for everyone to retain their immortal souls, they have to give him all their gold.
Wow.
So it's a very cynical satire of the influence of power on a person, or an aardvark.
And that's in the volume called Church and State. That's
Church and State, and leading up to it is High Society, which covers a lot of his election to PM. And between the two volumes of Church and State and High Society, you've basically got two giant phone books there to read.
Yes.
It's pretty awesome. Great political satire.
Is it funny?
It's very funny.
Okay. Yeah,
check it out. Next up.
Transmetropolitan.
Oh, Transmetropolitan.
Is that Warren Ellis?
Warren Ellis's comic based on the kind of the Hunter S. Thompson-esque
Gonzo
columnist.
Yep.
Yeah, Spider Jerusalem.
Yes.
Bald-headed, wears one red glass, one green glass
yes.
on the eyes.
Cool.
You might have seen, if you haven't read it, that's what the covers look like.
Yes.
It's a very kind of nasty comic, I would say. I guess it pushes the good taste envelope in many regards.
It's out there. It's kind of, it's almost like Robocopy kind of future set funny, like technology is taking over a lot of weird products and
that's right.
sex. And
they're breeding clones of humans to eat in fast food chains and that sort of thing, except it's not a big twist everyone knows and it's delicious. You know? But what happens in this volume, Year of the Bastard...
Is that volume 3?
Volume 4, I think.
Okay.
Yep. Spider Jerusalem comes reluctantly out of his self-imposed hermitude to cover the Democratic Convention. He's not happy to do it, but it's between two candidates. One's an openly fascistic monster, basically.
You just spat on me when you said that.
Fascistic. I'm so sorry, Chris. Why'd you have to tell everyone? I'm done. I'm gone. I'm finished with this.
Fine. Okay, this is the Chris show.
Just sequential. And extra. Yeah, and the other candidate's a mysterious, I suppose he's a bit of a political darling, but okay. No one knows much about him. He's just this handsome guy, and they call him the Smiler. And
it's not Tom Cruise, is it? Tom Cruise's son in the future?
No, but he's basically the most dull-looking kind of
okay.
straight-laced political guy, and Spider has to overcome his indifference in the campaign and his hatred of his archenemy, who's the incumbent president. He's basically this Richard Nixon-esque character.
Yep.
And he has to realize and recognize which is the lesser of two bastards. So another cynical satire.
Wow.
And, of course, there's quite a bit of sneaky political and Violet turns in the comic. I'd check it out. It's pretty good political stuff.
Is that Derek Robinson, the artist?
I wouldn't know.
Possibly. Okay. Also by DC is Fables.
Another Vertigo comic, would
yes,
it be?
Yes, yes.
Fables, Volume 4, but it's also an ongoing plot point that continues through the series.
It is. I think it's finishing soon, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Written by Bill Willingham.
Bill Willingham with a rotating roster of artists.
Yep.
With covers by the amazing James Jean.
Oh, that's he does awesome stuff.
Yeah.
Check out his website if you get a chance. He's quite the gallery artist. And yeah, great artist anyway.
Fables is basically the plot is all the fairy tale fable characters all used to live in this kingdom until they're invaded by the... It's not the opponent. It's something like that, isn't it?
You've not read it?
Oh, okay. Anyway, they all are forced to flee or they die, basically, from from their fable world.
Fable and town?
No, that's the new place they make in... I think it's in New York or some some American city.
Yep.
And... they all disguise themselves as normal people and they live there, except for the animal fables, which are forced to live on the farm.
Okay.
And one of the volumes is called Animal Farm, and it's about them rising up against. But it's, say, in this volume, number 4, I think it's March of the Wooden Soldiers, Prince Charming decides he's had enough of being in the background and being this sort of sly, kind of charming character. He decides to run for office.
Uh-huh.
And he uses, basically... every sort of popularist tactic you can to get in office, you know, charm the pants off women, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And he also makes an election promise to give everyone these charms which will make them appear human so they can all live normally.
Oh, okay, yep.
He isn't able to deliver on that promise in later volumes and that sets him up for failure. And it's this whole issue of there's a current mayor of the town, I think it's King Cole, for fairy tale character, and... whether it's right for him to challenge it at this stage of them being, you know, refugees basically from this war. But it's actually surprisingly three-dimensional kind of look at... It's not just painted as Charming should have never become president, because when he does, he leads the army against the opponent or whatever they're called. And he's much more aggressive. He's, say, the George Bush to King Cole's...
yes.
Al Gore.
No,
John Kane. Yeah. Or the Australian equivalent, I can't think of.
Yeah. We know about comics, not politics.
That's right.
And only when they two combine.
But that's an interesting election coverage there as well.
So it's got characters like Snow White, Big Bad Wolf is in there. Jack of Fables had his own spin-off series.
Yeah, he had his own spin-off series, yeah.
And it is a good series from what I understand. And I've people that don't read comics read Fables.
Yeah, like, quite it's a popular. Quite a, it's a good starting
good
point.
Good segue.
Mm. Next on the reading list.
Amazing Spider-Man. You know, in April 2009, Amazing Spider-Man, I think it was around the 400-491 series, Jonah became the mayor of New York. J. Jonah Jameson, have you seen in the film, he's the boss, Peter Parker, he's Spider-Man, Peter Parker's boss in the Daily Bugle. So he's the editor-in-chief. He had a heart attack, a whole bunch of stuff happened to him. His estranged dad, Jonah's dad, which he must think is like 80. So he came back into his life, and he ended up marrying Aunt May. So, effectively, that makes him Peter's cousin. And then the Daily Bugle blew up and a whole bunch of stuff happened. But anyway, J. Jonah Jameson is the mayor of New York City in the current Marvel comics.
Does he use his newspaper to help push his campaign?
Well, I don't think he can you? Legally, you can't have vested interest.
You can't legally, but that would have been an interesting little...
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I do not know. But, yeah, so it's been... he had a heart attack, his dad got married and he's the mayor of New York. So, J. Jonah Jameson... quite a busy young man.
Mm. Which particular volume trades should people pick up if they want to read more?
It started around Amazing Spider-Man 491 and is currently going today. So I think it started around the Civil War era.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get any Spider-Man comics from last year, you'll be able to see Jonah's rise into the mayorhoodness, mayorship.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
All right.
Every man.
Be the people.
I don't know nothing about this.
This is an indie comic which came out maybe 2 years ago. It might be harder to track down now, but I thought it's definitely on the topic. It's basically, it's the most left-wing comic you could find, I think.
Okay.
But it's telling an actual story, I would say. There's this new party starting up called One Love. And like Family First.
Yep.
No, nothing like Family First.
Oh, okay.
They're party founded on they want political and social openness, none of the bipartisanship, let's all get together and make the world a better place kind of party. And they're up against, of course, the right-wing incumbent government who are ready to do anything to stay in power. So it's very simplistically lefty, you know, every liberal conspiracy theory is on show here. The right wing are like messing with the electronic ballot boxes to get in power. I think there's an attempt to kill someone, you know, all this stuff. But it is very earnestly hopeful in the system. So if you're checking out an indie comic, that's an interesting one to check out.
Black and white, colour, publisher, writer?
It's black and white, and I can't remember any of those other things.
Okay.
As I told you, my notes got destroyed in a forest fire.
Yes.
Okay. Next up, Asterix and the Caesar's Gift. We talked about Asterix last week. This one's specifically about an election. A new family moves to the village, and they're expecting they kind of get this plot of land, and they think it's going to be this kind of Romanized modern town. Mm-hmm. And instead, they find a backwards village populated by violent lunatics, which is basically what Asterix is like.
Bummer, dude.
Yeah. So frustrated at their new surroundings, the guy's wife insists, and without his permission, sort of proposes he become the new chief of the village.
Okay.
Which is met by mixed reactions and the ensuing madcap madness of the existing chief and this guy, who are both the most unsubtle, loudmouthed,
yep,
you know, country bumpkins, basically. They both are rivals, and they're trying to get everyone's votes in the cheapest sort of ways possible through flattery and
bribery.
Bribery in the sense of, like, say there's a fish keeper there and they just keep going to his shop and go, "Oh, your fish are so good. Oh, I'm going to," you know, that's...
Love that halibut.
And the running joke in the series is this guy's fish are really unfresh because he gets them shipped over from basically Paris kind of thing, though they're right next to the ocean. Like, no, these are Paris's finest fish. Okay. You know?
They were 2 weeks ago.
But it's great because they're the outright lying, the cheapest attempts to win the votes on prejudice. And like, you're going to vote for these foreigners? And they're like, just basically from the next town down. You know? Okay. And meanwhile, the Romans are planning their attack and no one's noticing.
Oh.
So it's kind of this united we stand, divided we fall thing, when it's well delivered in another comic satire, but I would say less cynical than perhaps Cerebus and Transmet from before.
Asterix and the Caesar's Gift. Mm. Cool. Going back to DC, Ex Machina. The 50th and final issue has just been released actually this week. I'm not that familiar with the series, apart from a couple of issues, but what I do know is that it follows a guy called Mitchell Hundred, which sounds like a good name, like an action name. He's also known as the Great Machine. He was kind of like the world's only superhero. And it kind of, throughout the series, it follows the political wheeling and dealings, and also he flashbacks to his life as the Great Machine. And basically his origin is he was caught as this... trans-dimensional portal type explosion at Brooklyn Bridge, which now means he can talk to and control mechanical items like guns or cars, mm-hmm. or whatever it may be.
Do people know he's a hero?
Well, he retires from superheroism after 9/11, and then he becomes mayor of New York.
Cool.
So other superheroes and villains do kind of pop up throughout the series. You know, he has this backstabbing with his friends and family and whatnot.
So is it him deciding he can do more good as... in politics then on the street level kind of thing?
Sure, why not?
I haven't read it. I'm asking you.
Neither have I.
Oh.
I need a couple of issues.
I'm imagining that's how the politics
I would imagine so, because he retires from superheroism. So
that's
pretty much after,
soon,
after 9/11. Yeah, the 50th issue just came out.
Ooh.
Which I only said 2 minutes ago. Are you even listening to me? We don't talk
honestly
anymore.
Do you really want to know if I've seen that?
At that time I mentioned the word superhero, Maladam blanks out and starts drooling in the corner. I just have to poke him with a stick so he doesn't swallow his tongue.
The radioactive powers, what?
Let's talk about the French. And he's awake again.
Really?
So it talks about his time in office and flashbacks to his superhero days, as I said. Brian K. Vaughan is the writer. He wrote Why the Last Man, which I believe you're familiar with.
Yes, Why the Last Man.
Runaways.
Runaways, that's him, yeah, that's good.
Pride of Baghdad.
Yeah, that's one I was thinking.
That's an awesome series. Lions in the Iraq War. And
yeah, it's another political allegory which we missed.
That is true, actually.
We'll just chuck that in. Pride of Baghdad, another BKV comic.
Yes.
Basically, the animals stand in for the political factions. Check that one out.
It's a beautiful looking book as well.
Yeah.
Arted by Tony Harris, who did Starman when that started. It's quite mature.
Ex Machina, we're talking about now.
Quite deep, yes. It's published by DC Wildstorm. And if you go on comicbookresources.com, you can actually read a 2-part discussion between Vaughan, who's the writer, and Brad Meltzer, who's also another comics writer. And that kind of talks about the future, the backstory of the series, and all that kind of stuff. So check that out. All the volumes of Ex Machina are out now.
Second to last one on our list.
Duh-mm-zuh.
DMZ Volume 6, Blood in the Game. If you haven't picked up DMZ, it's one of Vertigo's flagship titles at the moment.
Like Fables, this is another book that I've recommended to people that don't like superheroes or are new to comics,
for sure.
They seem to like this.
Written by Brian Wood, who's also working on Northlanders at the moment, Viking comic.
Demo,
which he's doing new issues of now, isn't
it? Well, it's just finished his second volume, but second that is volume, an awesome series.
But DMZ basically sets up this concept of if in the US there was a splinter faction who decided to split from the US and they formed the Free States, which is in they make it in New Jersey, and the USA is on the mainland, and they're the separate factions who they've separated out, and in between them, on the island of Manhattan, is the demilitarized zone, the DMZ, which our hero Matty, or anti-hero Matty Roth, who is a journalist, training journalist, gets stuck there basically, and he's covering the injustice being served to this sort of DMZ by both sides. They're basically the innocent civilians caught between these two factions. That's a rundown of the title, basically. In this volume, the DMZ is at a point where they're going to run their first elections and sort of take charge of their own destiny, basically.
Okay.
So the USA is putting forth this puppet leader, and there's like going to be an election, but it's kind of like everyone's expected to vote for this guy. And what happens is Delgado, who's a charismatic street thug, kind of a cross between, may I say, Ice Cube and Che Guevara, he decides to run.
What a combo!
I know. So a very political guy, you know, he decides to run for the office. But there's vested interests from the US. There's a kind of, what's it called?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter. But it's a private security company who's in charge of the area. And their vested interests are at play. So, you know, will the people of the DMZ be able to be brave enough to, you know, take charge of their own place? Or will it all end in a bloodbath? Because this private security company does not want Delgado in charge, basically. There's an attempted, what's it called, assassination, which it's not clear whether Delgado's sort of tried to organize himself to get the pity vote. There's a bit of puppet master going on behind there. And Matty Roth, who's our hero, has to decide, you know, whether he's going to stay impartial or whether he's going to use his influence. He's kind of a little mini hero by this stage in the comic.
Okay.
Whether to, not a superhero, just a hero of the people for getting their stories out there, whether he'll take the side that he thinks is right. So it's got this hopeful belief in democracy in the face of human weakness and war in this war setting.
Blood in the Game.
Blood in the Game, DMZ. Check it out. Good stuff.
Last one is Jason Todd, who we talked about last week in the Batman Under the Red Hood DVD. Jason Todd was the second Robin after the first. Dick Grayson left for college and became Nightwing. Jason Todd was a tough street kid, orphan, who became, as I said, the second Robin after Dick Grayson, but he wasn't really that popular with the readers initially. Denny O'Neill wanted to get rid of him. Denny O'Neill's one of the writers of DC.
Just before this, Dark Knight Returns had come out. And there's a scene in the Batcave where you see a suit up and it's clear. It's like a memorial.
It's like a little hint that
Jason and this was before any idea that Jason Todd would be killed. And I think they maybe saw that and go, you know, that's not a bad idea.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So Danny O'Neill had this idea. He said, look, we should kill him, but let's give the readers kind of the choice. So what he did is...
give them the democratic choice to vote.
Power to the fanboy... girl people.
People got to vote whether to kill a small boy.
Woohoo! So 1900 numbers had just been created at this
time.
That's
right, yeah.
Is that the sex number? I don't know.
This was like 91-ish, like 1991?
No, this was like 1988, 89.
Oh, okay. All right, sorry.
So 1900 numbers had just been created. So in the back of the comics, there was like, if you want Jason Todd to live, vote for this number. If you want it to die, vote for this 1900 number. So over 10,000 votes were cast, phone calls were made, and the urban legend is that one fan programmed his phone to make calls every 30 seconds or something, and that made all the difference. The final tally was 5,343 to die and 5,271 for Jason to live. So it was quite close.
Yeah. By a close margin, the people voted to kill a teenage boy.
Yes. and you can read... the Justice. Effects of that in the Death and the Family trade paperback, which collects the storyline which occurred in Batman 426.
Yeah. Artwork by Jim Aparo, was it?
To 429, which was published in 1988 to 89. Jim Aparo wrote it. Jim Aparo drew it. Jim Starlin wrote it. And Mike Mignola, the Hellboy creator, was on the bloody covers.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what happened, Joker kidnapped Jason Todd and his real mum because Jason wanted to find out who his real mum was, and he tracked her down to three potential people. He found one who was like working in Ethiopia as an aid worker.
Yeah.
Joker kidnapped them both, tied them up, threw them in this warehouse in Ethiopia, beat Jason up with a crowbar, and put a bomb in just for safekeeping.
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically, if enough voters voted for Jason to leave, then it would have survived the bomb. But no, and now Jason Todd has come back all this time later.
Democracy in action, my friend.
As a bad guy. So that is actually, well, that's our top 10. We've got Lex Luthor, we've got Cerebus, Transmetropolitan, Fables, J. Jonah Jameson, Everyman, Asterix, Ex Machina, DMZ, and The Death of Jason Todd.
And you'll see that list on the website.
Yes, indeed.
Finally, a very brief
run-down. Yes, yeah. The last weekend of Comic-Con late July, the Eisner Awards, which were kind of like the Oscars for the comic book industry, were announced. So there's a whole bunch of awards. The full list is on our site, but we're going to be talking. Well, Volume 5 of Scott Pilgrim won Best Humor.
Yes, congratulations to Brian Lee
Scotty Boy, yes. David Mazzucchelli won Best Writer, Artist, and Letterer for Asterius Pollock,
which we'll go into detail on.
Pantheon. Yep. J.H. Williams 3 won Best Pencil or Inker. He's working on Batman, and a new number 0 issue comes out of Batwoman, in November. And the proper Batwoman series launches in January. And also the Harvey Awards also announced. And, yeah, as I said, the full list is on our website because it's quite the complete list.
Mm-hmm.
Stitches was
by David Small.
Hunter by Darwin Cook and Asterius Pollock are the three books that we're going to focus on because we read them all and they all turned up in those categories.
Absolutely. Shall we start with Asterios?
Asterios Polyp. So that's the name of the main character?
That's the name of the main character. Polyp, I think, is shortened from a Russian name or something. That's right. It's an interesting one. Basically, I don't know if he's an ex-architect, but he's living in a lonely flat and the comic starts with basically a fire starts and he has to grab a few items on his way out.
Yep.
He picks these three little innocuous items and he's out. You know, his whole architecture work goes up in flames, as does his apartment. And he's kind of left homeless and with not much money.
Yep.
So he decides to leave and he goes to a small town and you start to see through flashbacks the story of who he is and how he got there.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is how David Mazzucchelli crafts the story to tell that. It has a unique visual style, would you say, Chris?
There's a lot of white space, mm-hmm. I found.
Yep.
I've got to say, this and Hunter, which we'll talk about later, and Stitches are very handsome tomes. They're well presented. I love the dust jackets. They're thick paper. Asterius Pollock, there's a lot of white space, a lot of lines. Mm-hmm. Dave Mazzucchelli also did City of Glass, which I read this week, which is kind of similar, but kind of not really based on a book. Mm-hmm. And he also did Batman Year One with Frank Miller.
Yes, he did.
And then now he's kind of left and the mainstream comics have gone and become an indie darling.
Yeah. He's capable of a broad range of visual styles.
He is. And I was quite surprised when I first looked at this. I was like, what? It doesn't even look like his kind of stuff, you know? City of Glass has a different visual style. It's a bit more cartoony, I guess you'd say. Asterius seems a bit more abstract and kind of almost experimental. There's fewer lines.
Within Asterius, he goes through several styles because the conceit is basically every character or every person does see the world slightly differently from their viewpoint, and he explores that through Asterius, who's very hard-edged. He's got this very particular profile, this curved head, and it's like almost perfectly symmetrical, his head, so the back of his head and the front of his head.
Okay.
I think that plays on the twins thing that becomes a plot point in the comic, and then his girlfriend's this young Japanese lady who's much more fluid, bit more emotional and sort of calm, so she has a different style, and other characters are more cartoonish. You know, they set that out really well. And it also changes the colours for each of the characters, sort of, depending. It's not jarring. It works quite well, I think, in the setting of the comic.
It seems quite a fluid kind of narrative, and the pages kind of flow together quite well. Mm.
The good pacing through the comic,
yes,
I thought. Yeah.
Yes,
because of that white space, it rolls along quite nicely. And it's not just the line work, I thought I should say. The fonts for each character change.
Oh, okay.
So, like, it's not just uppercase and lowercase, like the actual style of font and the way they speak. You know, you get that from the just dialogue scenes. Yeah. So you could not have them on in the panel and you could tell he's talking as well.
That's true.
Yeah. And it's also, I thought, interesting because I guess he's an architect and all that. He does play into the character's an architect, I should say. He plays into the idea of the settings for them. So you see there a lot of the characters' apartments or houses, you sort of get an idea about what sort of people they are.
Yep.
So when you first see Asterius's apartment, it's basically trashed. And then in a later scene, you see it's, which is a flashback, I should say, you see he's first setting it up. It's all straight lined. It's all hard edged. He's a very modern kind of character. And it's a major plot point. Well, it's an interesting little plot point, I should say, when his girlfriend introduces the first curved line into his apartment, which is his coffee table. And he's like, what is this crap?
You know,
what is this modern?
Yes.
Yeah. But it's, I thought there's quite a bit of humor in the comic, actually, like more in the, how they act around each other and how oblivious they are, how oblivious he is when he's just being a total ass, because he's very arrogant. But overall, I'd say the themes are kind of, you know, it's about giving up the things you think define you.
Yeah, okay.
So, like, at the very beginning, he's forced to separate from his professional persona and sort of look at who he is and what's made him who he is.
Yep.
And I think David M. explores that through the comic.
David M.
Mazzucchelli.
Yes. I'm sure he'd like you to call that. Sounds like a rapper.
Did you like it?
It was good. It was interesting. It seems like one of those books that you could go into quite a lot of depth exploring and kind of looking at all the different themes.
Mm-hmm.
When you just flick through it, I mean, it's what, it's a few hundred pages and it's quite a large book. But yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, it's the type of comic I like, and I think comics, type of story comics are good at telling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of visual allusions and visual experimentation.
It delivered on some... Do you remember Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics?
Yes.
He did briefly mention once, this was like 96, wouldn't have been, something like that.
Yep.
That then, he did mention, why aren't there any comics which have several different styles in the same book?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then this delivers on that.
Okay, yeah. Good call.
Just occurred to me.
Hunter, Darwin Cook is a former animator. He's also worked for DC Comics. He did Catwoman for a while, Selena's Big Score, I think it was called, which is a pretty good book. He's done the Justice League New Frontier, which also got turned into an animated film. And he it's obvious that Darwin likes his 40s and 50s pulpy kind of stuff, because that's the stories he tends to focus on. Hunter is basically about that. It's a time when men were men and women were women, and political correctness and metrosexuals didn't exist. You know, cigarettes and hats were used indoors, and it's kind of like, you know, Mad Men, that kind of thing.
Frank Miller's creaming his pants at this conversation.
Yeah. It almost seems like another world, like set in the 50s. So
cigarettes everywhere.
Yes. Hunter is based on a novel by Richard Westlake, who goes by another pseudonym, who's, I can't recall off the top of my head, Richard Stark. Richard Stark Parker. And kind of like Hitchcock, a lot of the majority of the violence happens off panel. And it's obvious that Darwin has clearly thought long and hard about each panel and how it relates to the page as a whole. As I said, explored a similar time frame in Justice League New Frontier. And it's almost like when I was reading some of these captions out loud, I was putting on my best noir voice, like Mickey Rourke in Sin City, talking like this, you know. And when you flick through the pages just by itself, there's like quite a simple but a vibrant colour palette that goes throughout the whole book. It goes from like pink to yellow to blue.
Mm.
It's kind of soft, but even though the actual story is quite hardcore, like it's not one for kids.
It's very Chinatown, I thought.
Yeah, it is. It's about this old grizzled guy who's, there's women involved in it. A typical kind of pulp noir tale. But
what Sin City wishes it was, I think.
Yeah, kind of like that. Mm. It was thick paper. They used the Benday dots in the flashbacks. In the flashback scene. Benday dots are the old printing dots from the 50s and 60s.
He's going for an era.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And everything that he's made is selling the 50s, 60s era. It's an unlikable lead character. And even the detailed props, you know, like the kettles and watches and cars, and it's all from the 60s. It's like just sells that era so
Jack
well.
Jack Nicholson could play him.
the second Parker book that Darwin Cook is adapting is out in October, also from IDW. And that is called The Outfit. There's an oversized prelude to The Outfit, which is out now, called The Man with the Getaway Face. But yeah, The Outfit. Yeah, if you liked Hunter, The Outfit comes out in October, and that's definitely the one for you.
Should I say what I thought about it?
Please.
Or? I guess it's, I couldn't finish it. I thought in some parts it's very beholden to the book. Like there's, especially in the flashback sequences, it's most obvious.
Yep.
He just has whole chunks of the book, basically, the prose.
I'm not that familiar with the novels.
Neither am I, but there's basically whole pages where it's just the prose and then he'll have some pictures.
Yes.
And I felt maybe it's him feeling like he needs to include everything that's in the book.
Okay, yep.
And that... maybe to its detriment.
Yep.
Possibly.
Okay.
Did you? Maybe not for me. I thought it broke. It broke the pace.
Yeah, I did. I thought that it flowed quite well. But I do know what you mean. Yeah. Sometimes some pictures are text heavy. Some pictures are picture heavy.
Yeah. I thought he's very text heavy.
He's not afraid to use space. Mm-hmm. I felt. Not that familiar with the book. But I thought the words and the text worked so well together.
Yeah.
I thought there was a good selection of what to leave in and what to leave out. It sells the world so well. 1962, I think it's set in New York. But yeah,
I think it's a good piece for that sort of genre, of that sort of crime drama thing.
Yes.
If you're not interested in that crime drama, it won't convert you to it.
No, that's true.
It didn't in my case.
It's pretty hardcore and it's pretty sold in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't leave much room to budge, you know.
No, that's right. But from a very wordy comic, do we have anything more to say on it?
No, that's it. I'm done.
But from from a very verbose comic to a very... Unverbose.
Anti-verbose.
What genius. David Small's Stitches.
I'm not familiar with David Small. I don't know if this is...
I hadn't heard of him either.
No.
What Stitches is, it's an autobiographical piece of himself in from about, say, 6 or 7 to his early teens.
Yep.
It kind of tells a story of his... kind of his family that's been very distant from his parents, or they're distant from him. You get the hint that they don't really like him that much, or that's how he perceived it. And he gets cancer when he's quite young of the throat.
Okay.
And it becomes clear through the course of the novel that he got the cancer. His dad's some sort of doctor, I can't remember the type, but he tries to treat his son's coughing through x-ray treatment, which was popular in the whatever decade that was, and gives his son cancer, basically. Okay. And as a child, they don't tell him he has cancer, they just tell him he has a cyst.
Okay.
And it's all these other characters keep, like his dad's friends, doctors, you know, whatever, are doctors, and they notice the cyst and like, oh, have you seen this? You know, it could be whatever. And their parents just are like totally uninterested. And they're like, we don't have the money to treat this. But then they go off on a shopping spree when they get a bit of money.
No.
Like, you can tell where their priorities are. Yeah. They're both kind of self-absorbed people. And this breeds a bit of a resentment from David, who's our main character, to his parents. After his he finds out by accident years later what it was. Like, he finds a letter one of them had written to the grandmother saying that it was cancer and that they didn't want to tell him, kind of thing. So he obviously resents them for that, and he can't speak because his vocal cords had to be one of them had to be removed for the surgery. So you can like that, probably. But it's very minimal line work with these kind of tonal ink washes for the art, sort of.
Yes.
Yeah. But I thought his command of expression was very powerful.
Okay.
There's a sequence where he's confronting his mum after he's just sort of empowered himself a bit, and there isn't too much talking through the whole comic. It's all sold through these close-ups of their kind of looks, and they show the expression morphing between several different stages through a sequence of panels, and it's very kind of powerful. And that's how the story is told, much more through the expressions and how they react to each other. And the flashback scenes, did you have a chance to flick through it at least?
I did flick through it, but I just didn't have the time to read it.
Fair enough. There's some flashback scenes told basically on what the deal is with his mum, maybe. Like, she was born with her heart on the wrong side of her chest.
Oh.
Yeah, in reality.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah, apparently. Okay. And she was quite sickly sort of thing, and that sort of feeds into what her deal is, maybe. But those flashback scenes told, it's set in the 30s or something, they're very Eisner-esque. They look like Will Eisner's sort of style. They're much more cartoony. And later, I guess it's whose perspective it is, you know, because the grandma's telling the story, I think. And I thought it was interesting. He had this command of this much more kind of gestural, cartoonish, kind of like the spirit. Maybe more Contract of God-ish, actually.
Okay, yep.
But, and then the modern day or the present day him as a child stuff are more kind of wobbly and uncertain.
Okay.
So he knows what he's doing.
Yes.
Yeah. I definitely got... It's quite an affecting comic, and the fact that this stuff actually happened to him, you know.
Yeah.
Remember we were discussing a few weeks ago, these kind of autobiographical comics.
Yeah.
When the person has had a boring life, they're not very interesting.
No.
Boring life. Then my girlfriend broke up with me.
and then I caught the bus.
Yeah. Yeah, it's those. It's not slice of life. It's like, oh, it's crazy, some of the stuff he went through as a kid and the relationship with his parents. So if you're into that sort of thing.
It kind of reminds me of the film called Running with Scissors, which is based on a novel of this guy's real life. He gets adopted
by... The Weird Al Yankovic.
No, I think it's called Running with Scissors. Yeah, it's got a whole bunch of famous people in it. But yeah, cool. This guy gets adopted by a psychotherapist. And
okay.
He thinks he sees like God in the toilet and all. It's all very strange. Mm. But yeah, it really happened to this guy. So it's an interesting life.
Mm. And right. Yeah, great pace in this, and yeah, these kind of comics, just like the ones we're talking about, best kind of stories to tell through a comic.
Yes,
because you can show these little vignettes and these small parts of people's lives.
And all these three books, Hunter, Asterius, and Stitches, look good on the bookshelf. They're quite well, nice looking tomes. They're quite hefty. And
I would say with the Asterius Polyp, it's very cheap cardboard.
Well, the outside?
The inside. It's basically, it is an architectural reference. This is the kind of construction cardboard you use for making models.
That's true.
I got that straight away. But it doesn't weather very well. You can see already on our copy, the corners have gone. So you're going to take a special good care of it. Yeah. And the dust jacket doesn't stretch all the way up the book. It's an intentional choice.
Yes, it is.
It looks all right, but it won't age well, I don't think.
No.
Just a little minor quibble. Otherwise, it's a good book to check out.
Yes.
They won't look as good in soft cover, that's for sure.
No, that's true. Website of the week time, thecurfewgame.com, thecurfewgame.com. It's created by comics writer Kieran Gillen. He's actually an ex-video game journalist and reviewer, and then he started writing comics. His run on Marvel Comics Thor has just ended, but he's also known for Phonogram, the independent title. So basically, if you go on thecurfewgame.com, I've had a little bit of a play around, but I thought it fits in well with today's political theme. It's basically a game you play online, and there's four different characters. There's the boy, the immigrant, the dissident, and the policeman. It's made by animation studio Little Loud, who do a lot of work in England. It's also supported by Channel 4 in UK and Amnesty International, because it's all about human rights and human equality and that kind of stuff. Basically, you just move your cursor around on the video, you click on different characters, they talk to you, and then you kind of go, you're getting more clues, and you go throughout this world. It's pretty seamless. It loads quite quickly, and it looks like a classy independent film, really good cinematography. It's set in 2027, and it's kind of like this authoritarian security state in England where citizens have to abide by, you know, the harsh government rules, and then sub-citizens are placed under curfew at night. And according to the website, the player must navigate this complex political world and engage with the characters they meet along the way to work out who they should trust in order to gain freedom. Choose wisely and you can change the course of history. Choose poorly and it'll be changed for you. The curfew, worth staying in for.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a fun piece of interactive fiction.
So, yeah, if you've got some time to kill and if you want to look at this kind of world and know more, there's like lots of little clues and stuff. What are you doing there, Maladdin?
I'm asking how much does it cost?
Oh, I thought you wanted to smoke.
I was rolling a cigarette.
Neither one of us do. It's free, so just jump
Lovely.
Online. There's quite a few little pop culture references and hidden things. Apparently cool. Kieran Gillen, even the writer, turns up as a corpse in the film. So you basically just talk to people, interview people, you find out more, and then you just work throughout this world.
Sounds good.
So, that is thecurfewgame.com. Hmm. That concludes.
Yeah, that wraps us up.
Sequential Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith.
3D.
3D.
Hope you enjoyed our post-converted three-dimensional podcast. Hope you didn't get a headache.
Next week we'll be talking about a bunch of stuff. We just don't know what it is yet. I'll probably be talking about The Darkness, which is a new series from Top Cow, new miniseries. Is it.
Next week will be a special surprise.
Yes.
For us too.
Yes, indeed.
If you come up with any ideas, feel free to mail them in, or any other comments you have, or you want to abuse us.
Yes, you can leave a comment at our website, extrasequential.com. You can email myself, Chris, with a K, chris@comicbookjesus.com. We would love and adore to hear from you, because we are sad, lonely men desperate for your attention.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially Maladdin.
Yes. Music you heard on the show, you heard some of the soundtrack for Scott Pilgrim.
Yep.
You can get any of those albums online or in your fine local music retailer.
Or even your non-fine local music retailer.
Crappy music retailers should have this album too.
Working out the back of his van
in the
car park.
Hey, you want a CD, buddy? Yep. And other music was by me. You can check out my tracks at purgeaudit.com.
Yes, that's it.
That's it.
Thanks for listening, as always.
Thanks for listening to Extra Sequential. See you next week.
Bye-bye.